to be in a place where I could know that my Latinidad was not at stake, that my Latinidad is actually very much about my sexuality, and that LGBTQ Latinos are actually a lifeblood of our culture, that's so incredibly freeing.
Welcome to In the Thick. This is the podcast about politics that examines the changing political climate through a diverse lens with voices that you probably don't often hear from a lot. My name is Maria Hinojosa. You can sense the difference in tone. This is a difficult moment for all of us. Of course, the tragedy in Orlando is, in fact, a particularly American one, because it brings together so many different parts of who we are, what people call intersectionality, this tragedy of diversity in so many ways. This conversation this week, a little bit different. I'm going to be joined, as always, by our political editor, Julio Ricardo Varela, who's in Boston. And we're also going to have with us Veronica Valletti Flores. She's a freelance writer and the co-host of Radio Mnea. And Shadi Hamid, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to In the Thick.
Hey, Maria.
Thank you so much for having me, Maria.
Thanks for having me.
We want to start with you, Veronica, because as we know now, the vast majority of the victims identified so far have been Latinos and Latinas. The mainstream media basically took a few days to catch up to this. The New York Times on Tuesday did have a front page piece about this, but actually when you read into it, it kind of talked about like LGBTQ people and Latino people, and almost like these two don't mix. So why do you think, Veronica, that the media struggled essentially to be explicit about these connections and the Latino-Latinx dynamic of this?
Yeah, I think that it's a lot of things, right? I think that a lot of folks from our communities, from our queer Latino, Latina, Latinx communities aren't always part of the media. And not having us there really affects the dialogue. But I think it's also taking a cue from our movements for civil rights and liberties. The reason that there's a Latino night at a gay club is because there's a lot of racism in LGBTQ communities. It's not a coincidence. And I think that both mainstream movements for LGBTQ liberation and Latino civil rights organizations have failed us.
Wow. Fill in that void. What should we have been reading about and learning about?
Well, listen, Maria, I think that both Latino civil rights organizations and mainstream LGBT movements could do a better job of thinking about what the consequences are for LGBTQ folks that are Latinos. We have folks talking about immigration that don't know anything about the ways that queer and trans and gender nonconforming people experience detention, about things like solitary confinement, about things like being denied HIV medications, about being placed in confinement with people that are not safe to you. It's a failure of mainstream Latino and LGBTQ movements to not see what the consequences of our intersectional lives are and what the policy priorities of our lives are.
I've been writing a lot about this, and I've been talking with members of the Latino community and the LGBTQ community. So what do you think is being lost in all this coverage right now?
What gets lost a lot in the media right now, coverage of this, is that a lot of the violence that we face has nothing to do with Islamic extremism as LGBTQ Latinos. A lot of the violence we face is actually sanctioned by the state. It's about deportations. It's about sexual assault at the hands of the police. It's about the detention bed quota, where Immigration and Customs Enforcement is forced to hold 34,000 immigrants every day on a daily basis as a matter of course. There's a lot of elements that someone from our community, people from our community caught pretty immediately. For example, the fact that the vast majority of the victims were from Puerto Rico, and that has a lot to do with an economic crisis that's crippling the island and having a lot of folks leave and land in Orlando specifically. There's a lot of things like what does it mean to be undocumented and a victim of these shootings? How are folks who are undocumented and survived this going to pay for their hospital bills, going to pay for their rent? There are particular things that if you're a member of our community, you know immediately what the folks' struggles are going to be that survived this and what the folks' struggles are going to be for families back home who didn't.
Veronica, the day after the massacre, you wrote an article for Remezcla. It was titled "The Pulse Nightclub Shooting Robbed the Queer Latinx Community of a Sanctuary." Can you talk a little bit more about this notion of a club as a sanctuary if you are gay, if you're Latino, if you're an immigrant, if you're undocumented, for all of those things?
Yeah, I think the word sanctuary is exactly correct. I think for many of us who either may have faced some rejection or some discomfort with our families, being at the club on Latino night was the first time we felt totally whole in ourselves, was the first time we felt totally free, and that we felt we could be ourselves in a really full way where we could think about our families and the rhythms of our people and be sexual in a way that felt good and normal and with people that shared our experience. So I think the word sanctuary is exactly right. I think for me personally, a Latino night at a queer club was the first time that I felt totally free in myself.
This is very emotional for you.
It is. For me, you know, my family loves me and my extended family in Venezuela loves me and are accepting, but it wasn't always that way. And to be in a place where I could know that my Latinidad was not at stake, that my Latinidad is actually very much about my sexuality, and that LGBTQ Latinos are actually a lifeblood of our culture, a really inextricable part of who Latinos are. That's so incredibly freeing. And it made me feel a way that I didn't know that I wasn't whole, but I found out in that moment that I hadn't been until then.
Julio, as Veronica just mentioned, almost half of the victims were Puerto Rican. The mainstream media was essentially pretty late to focus on this fact. The New York Times published an article on the impact of all of this on the Puerto Rican community on Wednesday morning. You are not thrilled with this article. So what's going on for you?
Within hours of the tragedy, the news really hit Puerto Rico very, very hard. And there was already a lot of discussion of the fact that 23 of the victims were of Puerto Rican descent. What the article really did miss was the fact that a lot of Puerto Ricans, a lot of gay Puerto Ricans were leaving the island because there has been a really ugly history of anti-gay violence on the island for years. And I was a little bit disappointed to see that it did not dig deeper into this history of like murders against gay people on the island, some very violent murders.
And in case anyone doesn't know it, Puerto Ricans are born American citizens. So they are not immigrants. They are not immigrating from anywhere. They are simply moving from a part of the United States to another part of the United States. They are not immigrants.
And the other thing is painting Puerto Rico as this sort of like third world country, drug infested country, and you know, Orlando had this sanctuary. It's just not as simple as that. I just wish it captured less of the foreignness of it and the fact that there's been deep roots in Orlando and with the Puerto Rican community for years.
Shadi, what's going on for you as you're hearing this part of the conversation? What's it bringing up for you?
To just see the level of hate, you know, in social media and even in national media coming from people like Donald Trump, mainstream politicians, and how they talk about us as Muslims, as the other, as some undifferentiated mass. Because I've lived, you know, six of the past 12 years or so of my life in the Middle East, I've seen some very disturbing things. But now that I'm seeing some of the same sentiment, let's say, here in my own country, that to me is a new thing. And the fact that someone like Donald Trump has broken the taboo, many taboos, over how we talk about these issues and how we talk about minorities in our country, you can't really undo that damage. Once the taboo is broken, once people feel empowered to espouse hatred, it's very hard to kind of put that back where it came from.
So, Shadi, you are, in fact, a senior fellow in the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Can you tell us, you know, what we should be thinking of in terms of how we talk about Islam in America in light of the attack?
I would hope that more Americans can make more of an effort to learn about Islam, which is a rich and diverse tradition over, you know, 14 centuries. And you know, that takes reading. It takes actually talking to real life Muslims. There are some of us in the U.S. There are a lot of Americans, according to various polls, that who haven't actually met a Muslim or who aren't aware that they've met a Muslim. And I think that's part of the problem here. It becomes, you know, it obviously becomes more difficult to express hatred towards a group if you know someone from that group.
President Obama kind of owned this moment, and he gave a speech where he railed against the use of the term radical Islam.
That's the key, they tell us. We can't beat ISIL unless we call them radical Islamists. There's no magic to the phrase radical Islam. It's a political talking point. It's not a strategy.
I think the issue with radical Islam, which, you know, Trump has become obsessed with as a phrase is that the word Islam is there. And I think that when you put radical in front of it, then people are thinking to themselves, oh, does that mean Islam is inherently radical? But, you know, that kind of association, I think, is problematic.
So, Shadi, you actually have said that this might be a naive view and that maybe we should, in fact, be using the term radical Islamism at a time when we're in this conversation saying, oh, we don't want to we want to stay away from, you know, perpetuating certain narratives. And you're saying, well, hold on a second.
I think there's a middle ground because I'm also not totally comfortable with this idea of downplaying the role and power of religion in saying, for example, that ISIS has nothing to do with Islam. I think it's self-evident that ISIS has something to do with Islam. We just have to debate what that something is in a nuanced, constructive way. And when I say something here, I guess I just mean that ISIS leaders and fighters clearly believe that what they're doing is commanded by God. They think that they're right. They are motivated by their own interpretation of religion. I, as an American Muslim, think it's a distorted, perverted understanding of my religion. And the overwhelming majority of Muslims throughout the world agree with me on this. But that doesn't mean we should dismiss that there is a tiny minority that actually they sincerely believe what they say they believe, you know. And I think that sometimes those of us who grew up in a more secularized background in the U.S. or Europe, you know, we have trouble relating to the power that religion has in many parts of the Middle East. And I think sometimes on the left, there's this presumption that religion is just a way of speaking about things that are actually material in nature, that, oh, what's really bothering people are economic issues or the fact they're struggling with poverty or unemployment, and that religion gives them a way to sort of express those grievances. I'm uncomfortable with that because I think it dismisses the lived experiences of religious people. That's not how that's not how they reflect on the role that religion has. So when someone says, "Oh, I want to join an Islamist movement because I want to get into heaven," I take that seriously, that they actually believe that what they're doing will help them get into heaven, and that we shouldn't dismiss that as being bizarre or irrational.
Did you know that In the Thick is a listener-supported podcast? So that means that basically you're supporting our podcast to get on the air. And your contributions are really key to our success. So if you believe in what we're doing here at In the Thick, support us with a gift at any level. It makes a big difference. If you can go to inthethick.org, take 1 second, click on the donate button. Every single contribution, you don't know how much it means to us. And it means that we're going to be able to continue to bring you these voices, these conversations, these perspectives when we need it the most in our country. Thank you. So far, Veronica has talked to us and really schooled us on LGBTQ issues in the Latinx community. Shadi, you've really helped us to understand about how we need to think about Islam in America in light of what's happening right now. Julio, you put a spotlight on the Puerto Rican community, both here and on the island. And so now I want to bring us all into the conversation so that we can really look at these issues together from a place of intersectionality. You know, as much as this is an LGBTQ story, it's also a story about people of color. The mainstream media, as it often does, has tried again to simplify this story, Muslim terrorists, LGBTQ victims. But in the process, they avoid the complex, the intersectional identities. And that's kind of invisible from their coverage. And of course, it's not just Orlando. Veronica, you write about this often. How can we do better reporting and have better conversations about this in a way that is really respectful of the complexities of all of our communities?
I think that this is a huge tragedy, and it gives us an opportunity to take a look at the ways that LGBTQ Latinos experience violence. I think that the conversation around LGBTQ rights has been focused in this country very much on marriage. And the truth is that marriage is fine, but that doesn't really change the material conditions of our lives in a lot of ways. For those of us who have trouble accessing health insurance, for those of us who have trouble with immigration stuff, you know, the marriage fight didn't do much for us. And we need to talk about how we experience violence in this country. And the truth is that we experience violence at the hands of the police. We experience violence in gender segregated detention facilities for where trans people and gender nonconforming people face extreme levels of violence.
And often solitary confinement with no explanation.
That's exactly right. We are facing so much violence in other ways. And to reduce this to a conversation, to one tragic event that that has only to do with a falsely created narrative around Islamophobia, it doesn't reflect the reality of our lives.
And at the same time, the attack has, for someone like Trump, really allowed him to increase his Islamophobic comments. Let's take a listen to some of the things he said.
We have to be very strong in terms of looking at the mosques, you know, which a lot of people say, oh, we don't want to do that. We don't want to do that.
The bottom line is that the only reason the killer was in America in the first place was because we allowed his family to come here.
It would be easy, you know, enough to brush these kinds of comments aside. But the truth is that they are resonating with a large part of America. But we also know that according to census data, 56% of America is going to be non-white by 2060, if not earlier. If this is happening before we get there, are we going to expect more violence?
I've come to accept the fact that it's yes. And I look back at history. I think we're at a point in this country where change is good in the eyes of many, but threatening in the eyes of few. In a country that is changing dramatically, demographically, there's going to be tension. And sadly, it breaks my heart to say this, but I don't think that this type of this type of attitude towards the non-white population in this country is going to just go away lightly. And the only way that changes is if people keep speaking out.
Right now, we have a presidential candidate who is throwing salt on the wound, right? Veronica, is there a part of you that as a journalist and also as a queer Latina wants to label Trump and wants to see other media label him as a racist, as a white supremacist?
I'm very clear that all of those things are true. And it's shocking to me that anybody would not believe those things. That to me is very obvious. And it's really hypocritical to me to hear statements about using Islamophobic narratives to protect LGBTQ Americans when I have seen him take absolutely no actions on the actual concerns that LGBTQ Latinos, who were the folks that were attacked on Sunday morning, he's never taken any of that seriously. He's never taken a look at what our policy concerns are. Our policy concerns are comprehensive immigration reforms. They're not a wall. Our policy concerns are the same concerns that many other Latinos have and also are specific to the ways that we express our gender and express our sexuality.
So, Shadi, what about your thoughts on the labels or the non-labels for Donald Trump? I mean, you're from the Brookings Institution, but at the same time, you're a Muslim American. You understand deeply the real consequences of some of the policy positions that Donald Trump has taken. Where do you stand on what he should be called?
I'm less concerned with the exact label and more concerned with the ideas and that he's promoting into the mainstream, the taboos that he's breaking. I think the next few decades are going to be fascinating and frightening in the sense that we are going to be seeing this transition away from let's say, white majority domination of the political and economic system. Do we actually see a redistribution of power in a more equitable way? You know, look, people are going to hold on tight. They're not going to be comfortable giving up those privileges. And that's why I think, you know, Trump has tapped into this white nativism in a very powerful way.
One of the things that's interesting about this, there are now a lot of prominent Republicans probably reaching the last straw with what Trump and it's not that their language, but if you start looking at Republicans that are saying that this is the line that might have been crossed, there are Republicans out there who still will say that there are certain things that he's saying that are inherently and essentially un-American. And that is the only little glimmer of hope that is coming out from the political sphere that I can even begin to kind of digest here.
That's interesting to me because I feel like what Trump is saying is actually very American. I think that racism and colonization is actually what this country is largely built on. And we like to talk about how this country was built on freedom, but it was also built on slaves and on the genocide of indigenous people and on the oppression of folks like LGBTQ Latinos. So in some sense, I think it sounds very un-American what Trump is saying, but on the other hand, I think that it's actually distinctly American.
We are going to move on to our final segment. Noam's family, Liz, our producer, and his family came up with a list of things that you can choose to have as your final comment. And so the topics are fantasy CNN, what's missing, tough questions, and what we've got wrong. So, Shadi, which one of those do you want to pick to finalize?
So, I guess I'll pick tough questions. I mean, my tough question for Donald Trump, and I kind of wish that I would have the opportunity to just sort of, it'd be just like fun to confront him, like in a corner or something, and ask him and see like
he's
how.
He's got a lot of security, Shadi. I hate to tell you.
He'd be like, oh my God, there's a Muslim guy who's coming close to me. In his national security speech after the Orlando attack, he went further than he's ever gone before, where he was pretty much saying that parents of Muslims who are currently in this country, maybe they shouldn't have been allowed to come in the first place. And if we had had these controls earlier, then, okay, we could have prevented this or, you know, Orlando attack or whatever. So I guess my question, my tough question to Donald Trump would be that, do you realize if you had your way, my parents wouldn't have been allowed to enter this country in the first place, and I wouldn't be here asking you my tough question.
Mm.
And how do you feel about that?
Yeah, on the spot. But again, don't try that unless you've got your own security yeah. because he's got massive security and I really want to keep you safe, Shadi.
Thank you.
Veronica, what would be your choice?
I'm going to go with what's missing. And I would also like to end on a little bit of a happier note. I'd like to remind our listeners and think about the fact that June is Pride Month. And Pride is actually the first Pride ever was a celebration of the 1 year anniversary of a time where mostly queer and Black, queer and Latino and Black and trans folks fought back against police discrimination. And it's an anniversary of resistance and it's an anniversary of perseverance against tragedy and violence. And our community as LGBTQ Latinos are sadly really quite familiar with tragedy. And yet we still have so much joy and yet we still resist every single day. And we're going to keep doing that. And I think that it's important to remember that it's Pride and we're going to keep resisting.
Julio, your final comment.
Mine is what's missing. And in this whole tragedy, especially with the media, Orlando is missing. And I have a deep personal connection with Orlando. My family in Puerto Rico moved to Central Florida in 1989. So I have been part of the Orlando community for 27 years. No one's really talking about Orlando as a haven for LGBTQ community in the way that it should be. I see it from a very, you know, media museum reporting where it's like, oh, there's gay people in Orlando. But having seen my brother, who's a producer and a performer, actually have, you know, he's produced so many shows and the performing community, the performing arts community in Orlando is thriving. And it really hit home hard. It really hit home hard to a lot of people who perform in Orlando. And I think we need to see more of that Orlando and not the Disney Universal Orlando, where everyone thinks Orlando is a very strong community. I have deep roots in it, and it just pains me to see it suffering.
I'm also going to choose what's missing. This is a shout out to reporter Soraya Chimali from Rolling Stone. The headline of the piece that she wrote, "In Orlando, as usual, domestic violence was ignored as a red flag." Wow, we're looking for all of these external things, and yet just look at the relationship inside that home. And how about if we start looking at that? I really want to thank every single one of you for being on In the Thick this week. It was difficult, but I'm really proud of the conversations that we had. Veronica Bayetti Flores, writer for Remezcla and Feministine, Shadi Hamid, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and the author of a new book called Islamic Exceptionalism: How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. And Julio Ricardo Varela, the political editor for the Futuro Media Group. Thank you all for joining me on this week's episode of In the Thick.
Thank you so much, Maria, for having me.
I'm your host, Maria Hinojosa. Remember, if you can go to iTunes to rate and review us, it'll only take you a second, but what it does for us is deliver new listeners who I know you believe should be listening to these conversations. So rate and review us on iTunes, follow us at In the Thick Show on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and tell your family and friends to listen. Our producer is Noam Hassenfeld. Our director of content is Ted Canova. Some of our music is composed by Noam, and other music that you heard is courtesy of Nacional Records. And we'll see you around next time, right here on In the Thick. Ciao.